The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, I do not know what episode number this is, but today is Black Friday. It is 2023, the day after Thanksgiving, and exactly 1 week after the OpenAI board pushed out Sam Altman, the CEO, and Greg Brockman, who had been the head of the board. If you're interested in this topic, you've surely been, you know, following it in pretty minute detail, or maybe not. I know that I've heard from some people who said, you know, they'd kind of heard about it, but they didn't really get any details until they watched a video that I put out. But anyway, OpenAI is a very prominent company. Their product, ChatGPT, and, you know, GPT-3, GPT-4, and all the various things that are built on those large language models have attracted millions of customers in a very short amount of time. They've made a lot of money. They started out as a nonprofit. They started out as like a research institute. And they also started out creating open source AI models. And somewhere along the line, they decided, no, they can't really be putting these things out open source anymore. They have to keep control over them. And it costs a lot to train these models. They need to make a bit of money. So they've partnered with Microsoft. And they've created a portion, like a second entity that is controlled by the nonprofit board. But the second entity is a for-profit wing of the company, but it's a limited profit structure such that, you know, they've partnered with Microsoft, and Microsoft can make up to $100 billion in profit from their association with OpenAI and no more. It's a very strange sort of thing. And there is there's a split, an ideological split within Silicon Valley and within the AI world, but also within OpenAI. A lot of the people on the board, like all the people on the board, in fact, have no equity in the company. And, you know, they don't make more money if the company makes more money. And their ideological position is that the purpose of this organization called OpenAI is to create safe artificial general intelligence, which improves the lives of all humans. Whereas, you know, a for-profit corporation, their goal is to maximize return for the shareholders. And Sam Altman, the CEO, according to some members of the board, was being reckless. He was pushing things ahead too quickly. He was, you know, pushing out products to the public, which is to say giving normal people who are not part of the AI research community access to some of these AI tools. And there are a lot of people who think that this is very dangerous. Not a lot of people in terms of percentage of the population. Most people have no opinion. But within the AI community, there's a sizable faction that thinks that this stuff is very dangerous. It needs to be developed in secret. It needs to be kept from the public. And, you know, from my perspective and the perspective of a lot of people, I think, that basically is just a formula for, you know, maintaining control over this very powerful technology until it is so powerful, basically to have the genie on your side and not working for everybody, but working for you. And yeah, you think you're a good person and you've articulated some, you know, some laudable points of view, but power corrupts. So from my perspective, I'd much rather see this technology get pushed out to the public. But there is an organization, it's a company, it's called Anthropic AI, and it was founded by people who left OpenAI over safety concerns. And Anthropic makes the AI chatbot called Claude, or Claude 2, which I interact with every day. I also interact with Pi every day. I have no interaction at all with anything from OpenAI. OpenAI's GPT-4 powers the Bing chatbot, but I played with it for a little while at first, but I don't have much use for it. So I'm not really a user of any OpenAI products, but still, this is a huge story. It's dominated the attention of so many of the people whose, you know, whose output I follow on places like Substack and YouTube, and most importantly, I guess, would be Reddit. And, you know, the drama has played out on Twitter, aka X, between the various players. But a week ago today, Ilya Sutskever, who is a protege of Geoffrey Hinton, who is a pioneer in the current paradigm of artificial intelligence. He was a senior researcher at Google. Basically, he just got paid a fat salary to sit around and be the famous old guy at Google, kind of like Ray Kurzweil. And he left Google earlier this year so that he could ring the alarm bells about the dangers of AI. So basically, he left behind a sinecure, you know, a well-paying, high-status job that doesn't require a lot from you, in order to go out and, you know, ring the alarm bells. Although, if you were to be cynical about it, you could say he just went out to parlay his AI status into a more mainstream sort of celebrity. And Sam Altman was definitely parlaying his status into mainstream celebrity, much like, I'm not saying he's a criminal like Sam Bankman-Fried, but he was a lot like Sam Bankman-Fried in that his is a name and a face which is recognized in Washington, D.C., and he's being invited to provide testimony and expert guidance to lawmakers as they grapple with the question of artificial intelligence. And it is largely because Sam Altman is such a celebrity and because OpenAI is such a, you know, a prominent company and a prominent organization in, you know, even in mainstream consciousness, that this was such a big story. So I've talked so much about the financials behind this, about who has a financial stake in what, because when an organization like OpenAI is run by a bunch of people who don't have any equity in the company, their personal financial success is not tied to the success of the company, they can behave in a very ideological fashion. Whereas if you are the CEO of Google, or if you're the CEO of Microsoft or Amazon, you have to do what is going to make money for your company. And you'll probably have to either moderate or go against or just ignore your own personal vision from time to time if it's not perfectly in line with the bottom line. So, Ilya Sutskever, protege of Geoffrey Hinton, who is himself, I won't say a doomer exactly, but definitely somebody who is very concerned with the topic of AI safety and thinks that, you know, alarm bells need to be rung on the topic. He was on the board, and he was instrumental in getting Sam pushed out. Greg Brockman, who with both Elon Musk and Sam Altman, was a co-founder of the company. He was the head of the board, but he got pushed out along with Sam Altman because he and Sam were both, I guess, in the eyes of the rest of the board, equally guilty in terms of pushing profit, pushing growth, pushing the integration of AI models into various tools that lots of people have access to far too quickly. And I mentioned Anthropic and Claude because this is a company that was started by people who left OpenAI over safety concerns, and they kept all of their models basically under wraps. And Google as well was developing AI and large language models and had, you know, had models with impressive capabilities that they did not release to the public until GPT-4 was released earlier this year. And that basically put pressure on everybody else to get into the game or, you know, to be left behind in terms of commercial application of these tools. This board has been together for a while. Why freak out just now? Well, just a few weeks ago, OpenAI had an event that they called Dev Day or Developer Day, and they talked about the various projects that they're working on. And for a lot of people who are very into AI for its own sake, they were kind of disgusted at Dev Day because it did seem like basically just a commercial affair advertising new commercial products and was really like a co-branded with Microsoft event sort of thing. It wasn't co-branded with Microsoft, but, you know, that's how critics, that's how they characterized it. And at Dev Day and in interviews recently, Sam Altman said something to the effect of, just a handful of times in my experience with this company, I got to be in the room when we pushed back the veil of ignorance and advanced the frontiers of knowledge. And he didn't specify what he meant when he described, you know, this thing that he had witnessed that represented, you know, a pushing back of the veil of ignorance and an advancement of the frontiers of knowledge. But now, after this firing, or, you know, after this this power struggle, it's come out that there's something called Q Star. I think it's an algorithm, or possibly it is a fully fledged large language model, but it is some new technology that has been developed at OpenAI. It has not been released to the public. It is not integrated into any tools that the public has access to. This is something that is strictly in-house. And apparently, it's so good at something that some people are saying that OpenAI has achieved artificial general intelligence in-house, basically behind closed doors, and that this is such a big deal that it is paramount, that, you know, this forces the hand of the people who are really concerned with safety and who don't like all of these new technologies being made into products, pushed into the marketplace, and given over to the use of millions of people. Now, for a lot of you, this will be review because you've been following this story, but Sam Altman pushed out on Friday. Over Saturday and Sunday, there's basically dueling Twitter posts, and Sam basically rallied the support of almost everybody at the company. There's fewer than 800 employees at the company, and 760-something, I think, signed an open letter to the board saying, either you, the board, resign and let Sam come back, Sam and Greg, let them come back, or we are all going to go with Sam and Greg to Microsoft and work in their new, you know, their new AI division, or their new, you know, AI research initiative. And so the board relented, and most of the old board left. It was a small board. I think there's only like five people on it. And one of them was a guy named Adam D'Angelo, who is the CEO of the website Quora, which is a site that, you know, you go and you can ask a question, post a question, and lots of other people will post answers, and then people vote on, you know, what answer they think is the best. And a lot of times, if you just ask a question, say, to Google, just type it in the form of a question rather than just putting in, you know, a topic and looking for things on that topic, a lot of times you'll get directed to Quora entries. Well, Quora has an AI project called Poe, which some people thought would be a competitor to some of OpenAI's new products. And there was talk for like a day and a half, basically, of this all being Adam D'Angelo's fault. Like, he had a conflict of interest. He thought that OpenAI's products would be competing with his products, and he had a financial stake in the success of his company. He did not have a financial stake in the success of OpenAI. And so he just defaulted to his own economic interests. Well, of the new board, the only member of the board that pushed Sam and Greg out who has been retained is Adam D'Angelo. Ilya Sutskever is gone. Helen Toner is gone. There's another young woman on the board. I forget her name, but basically it was a very young board. And, you know, young people can be much more impulsive and ideological, or, you know, intense in their ideology than older people. The new board, Adam D'Angelo is retained on it. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, is on the new board. Definitely not a young feller. And there is talk now that Sam and Greg are returning of expanding the board, putting like another 9 people on it. So you're not going to have just this tiny cabal of people who have no financial interest in the success of the company, but who do have strongly held opinions about AI, who are willing to nuke the company. And something that Helen Toner said was that the original intent of the organization was not to make $1 billion. It was to develop safe artificial general intelligence. And if it's not going in that direction, then destroying the company would be the thing that she would be required to do as the keeper of the flame, as the person who is actually shepherding the company and making sure that it stays in accord with its original vision and mission. And I have to say, Sam Altman and Greg Brockman have been portrayed by most everybody I've seen covering this as the heroes, as the parties who have been wronged. Very few people that I've read online or seen in YouTube videos or anybody, you know, who's voicing an opinion on this has taken the side of the board and said, yeah, Sam was irresponsible. He did, you know, push this out to the public too quickly. And yet I'm actually sympathetic to someone like Helen Toner, who would say, I know this is an immensely unpopular thing, that this is a hugely profitable company, but it's not doing what it was supposed to do. And I think that the principled response is to just burn it down. I mean, it's drastic. It seems like ideologically so pure as to be unworkable, but at the same time, intensely principled. So I'm not, like, for a time early on, it seemed that Ilya Sutskever was the one who was really kind of the mastermind behind pushing Sam out. And it came out that he's really very, not just ideological, but kind of manic on the topic of AI safety. He thinks AGI is so close that at company events, offsite events, like, you know, holiday parties and things, he had employees chanting, feel the AGI, feel the AGI. And he would ask new hires, or, you know, people who are interviewing for the company, if they could feel the AGI without telling them, you know, what that meant. And this from somebody, you know, who applied at the company and ended up going to work someplace else. Kind of crazy. I mean, sounds crazy. But when you've got more money than you can ever spend, and you're working at this venture, which is very high profile, but at the same time, it's not making you any richer than you already are, really. Like Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, he had no equity in the company, which means no stock options, and his salary was exactly enough to pay for his healthcare. You know, he was rich from previous ventures. It's not that he was living in poverty in order to do this work, you know, for its own sake, but he had definitely divorced his work in the company from a personal profit motivation. And so you've got all these people, you know, who were inside of a structure that looks like a corporation. It looks like, you know, your typical corporation with, you know, executives who have equity and a board who also have equity. And, you know, the founder typically maintains enough equity and enough control over voting shares in order, you know, so that he can't be forced out against his will, or so that he or she cannot be forced to embark upon some, you know, some course of action which is antithetical to their vision. And you don't have any of that sort of founder control in a not-for-profit company that, you know, isn't set up to make money. And so, you know, at some level, when I first heard about OpenAI being a nonprofit and then adding a capped for-profit side to the company, I thought, you know, that sounds really, really progressive. I mean, that's great that, you know, they're elevating their vision for this technology and how it will impact society over personal profit. That just sounds really enlightened. And yet, when it comes to governance, it lets people do crazy things. You know, it lets people act really impulsively. And in fact, it encourages them to act impulsively. Eliezer Yudkowsky, who he runs the, what's it called these days? He runs a nonprofit, which is it's a research-oriented organization which is dedicated to finding a path to, you know, artificial general intelligence, which is safe. And he's pretty much the arch doomer. And a point that several people have made in the last week is that just because you have concerns about AI safety doesn't make you a doomer. And I agree. A doomer is somebody who thinks we're doomed. A doomer is somebody who thinks that a negative outcome is overwhelmingly more likely than any sort of positive or even acceptable outcomes. And by that strict standard, Eliezer Yudkowsky is still an AI doomer. He thinks that AI is going to be a competitor with humanity and that there will be no competition, you know, that it will run roughshod over us and discard us and we will be done. And he thinks this is going to happen soon. He posted a couple tweets that I thought were pretty, I generally don't like what he has to say, but these I did enjoy. The first was, he said, "It seems like tech Twitter has totally gone over to the mainstream dark side and they only," I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it up in front of me. He says, "they only focus on money and power and they cover it like a horse race, the same way that they do politics. And I've noticed that the mainstream, you know, news organizations in covering this story have treated it like one, either a political contest, you know, between rival politicians or a sort of hostile takeover or, you know, an adversarial corporate action," which technically it was, but it didn't play by the same rules as, you know, your standard corporate competitions. Somebody sent me a link to a Washington Post version or a Washington Post story, you know, and not in the early days, a more recent Washington Post sort of recap of what happened. And the word safe, S-A-F-E, which would include safety, only appears twice in this long essay. And in one of the appearances of the word safe is in Helen Toner's bio in an insert. It's not even in the text of the story. So this whole thing is basically a result of differing points of view on the topic of AI safety, catalyzed by the creation of some incredibly new, powerful, or seemingly very promising AI element of some kind that drove all of this. And when the Washington Post covers it, you know, they just cover it in terms of, you know, a power struggle between individuals at a corporation. But the other tweet from Eliezer Yudkowsky that I really got a kick out of was, "Enjoy the first quarter of 2024. It will be the last quarter in which, you know, major AI-inspired calamities do not dominate the news cycle." Is that true? I don't know. 2024 is an election year. Even if AI, even if there's like a hard takeoff of, you know, artificial intelligence just rapidly bootstrapping and reiterating and getting much, much better, I think the presidential election in the United States is still going to dominate the news, at least in the U.S. and most likely in all of the English-speaking world and, you know, all of Western Europe or all the EU and basically the Anglosphere and NATO. You know, because OpenAI is dedicated to safely getting us to AGI, artificial general intelligence. Well, that raises the question, what is general intelligence or what is artificial general intelligence? And it has been redefined, I don't know how recently, but this is the definition that's floating around at OpenAI right now. It's when computer models or artificial intelligence models are as economically relevant as human beings in most job tasks. That doesn't mean that the computer has a soul. It doesn't mean that it's self-aware. It just means that in terms of doing economically relevant work, AI models are as good, if not better, than humans in most respects. To me, that is not necessarily a lowering of the bar for AGI, but it definitely is a very narrow definition, which I think a lot of people, it just doesn't even touch on aspects of AGI that I think would be important to a lot of people, like sentience or self-awareness or, you know, a sense of self or a sense of morality or a sense of being in some way related to humanity and other forms of life, a desire to perpetuate itself into the future, a desire to self-replicate. All of these things that we think of as being aspects of life are not included in this definition of artificial general intelligence. It's strictly economic in its focus. And really, I think that's appropriate right now because that's really the big fear is what are we going to do to provision people with the things that they need to live if most people don't have skills that are relevant, that can compete meaningfully with algorithms? Now, for the time being, to me, it seems like the safest jobs in the world are like plumber or HVAC technician, or like I did last winter, snowmaker. You know, anything that involves you as a human being moving through the world physically, through over uneven terrain, through, you know, complex, surprising environments filled with irregular features, and then going out into the world, identifying things that need to be changed, working out how to do those changes, and then physically guiding your body through the process of manipulating objects in the world in order to affect the change that your cognitive problem solving informs you needs to be done. Those jobs, I think, will be safe long after pretty much every sort of doctor, certainly every sort of lawyer, every sort of engineer, computer programmer, writer, artist. I mean, all of those jobs will fall before the plumber or the electrician or the snowmaker, you know, or the HVAC guy. Dog catchers. Somebody who understands how to safely interact with animals. That's going to be safe, you know, long after much more technically sophisticated and right now prestigious professions have fallen by the wayside, you know, to have been eclipsed by artificial intelligence. Maybe not even artificial general intelligence, just narrow intelligence operating, you know, trained within that field, doing what this class of human being used to do. So again, you know, every time the issue of, well, what are we going to do once humans are not as good as either machines or algorithms at certain economic, you know, formerly economically relevant tasks, how do we provision people? And, you know, the lowest hanging conceptual fruit here is universal basic income. Just send everybody a check, give everybody money, let them go out and buy what they need. And, you know, there are many objections to this, but one that I read on the Singularity subreddit, just, I think it was just this morning, was somebody saying, hey, suppose we figure out a way to do it so that everybody gets an equal amount. And everybody, you know, is somehow, you know, if all the current inequalities are leveled out and everybody is made equal, how can ambitious people who want to better their situation do so if money, you know, is, if there are no jobs, if there are no opportunities to go out into the world and apply your drive, your ambition, your intelligence, your creativity, you know, to create something new and to better your own situation? Isn't that going to lead to a lot of frustration in, you know, in high competency people? And I'm not really worried about that because there's not going to be any leveling. There's not going to be any effort to basically expropriate wealth and property from people who have a lot of it right now to distribute equally to everybody. At least human governments are not going to do that. Human corporations are not going to do that. Now, if the AI surpasses us and just takes control of everything, that might happen. But, you know, that's a very different world. That's not the near future, hopefully. I don't think that's the near future. You know, that's maybe 100, 200 years from now, but who knows? Maybe 30, 40 years from now. I don't think it's 5 or 10 years from now. I think the momentum, the inertia, the habit of, you know, the way the world runs now is going to be very difficult to change. In some ways, that'll be a good thing. In some ways, that'll be a very frustrating thing. So, back to OpenAI for just a minute. Right now, it stands that Sam Altman and Greg Brockman are coming back. At the same time, it seems, you know, they've accepted a position, or they've accepted positions at Microsoft, creating a new, you know, a new organization within Microsoft devoted to AI research. And as far as Satya Nadella seems to be saying, that's still happening. Like, Sam Altman's going to both be the CEO of OpenAI and he's going to run this new organization within Microsoft. It would seem that one or the other would need to be the case, you know, that they wouldn't both be going forward. But one of the rumors as to why the board pushed Sam out was that he was also incubating a new AI venture outside of OpenAI. and that they thought that this would present either a conflict of interest with the well-being and the success of OpenAI, or that it would just exacerbate the generalized risk, you know, to humanity from artificial intelligence run amok that is embodied in the person of Sam Altman. But, you know, to fix that, you pretty much have to call in a hitman and kill the guy. Just pushing him out of OpenAI isn't really going to do anything. I mean, if they hadn't taken him back, if the old board had stood strong and said, absolutely not, he cannot come back, we will rather burn the company to the ground than see this man in charge of it again. He is a fundraising force of nature. He is, you know, world famous, and he has a very impressive track record. And he has a social network. I mean, he knows everybody in this world. He could immediately start a new company with the same level of funding as OpenAI, either, you know, build a huge new data center full of the, you know, the NVIDIA, what is it, H100 processors, or, you know, partner with some other company to build some custom design chip. Eliezer Yudkowsky, again, he was tweeting about this today, and he said that, maybe it was yesterday, I don't know. He said that he met Sam Altman and talked to him for 5 minutes at a party once. That's the only contact he's ever had with him, you know, face to face. And Sam said to him, what should I do? And Eliezer said, design custom chips so that whatever it is that you create can't be stolen. You know, it can't be expropriated by the government. It can't escape out onto the internet and just run willy-nilly everywhere. It can only run on your custom hardware. And that is something that Sam was talking about doing before the board pushed him out. So to me, that does not sound like somebody who is rampantly irresponsible. I mean, that is a safety measure. You know, the have it run on your own custom hardware is a safeguard from letting, you know, from your AI escaping out into the internet. But the question that comes to my mind when thinking about when will OpenAI be achieved and where, likely it will be inside the research departments of big corporations like Microsoft or Google or something like OpenAI. I don't think it's going to be the military or the government. I think that all the best minds and all the most advanced thinkers and all the most advanced technology is being developed in the private sector, at least in the United States. But how will we know when AGI has been achieved? I just don't have an easy answer to that question. I think when it is achieved, the desire for most people, you know, who are a participant to it will be to keep it a secret. To keep it under wraps until they understand it, until they know that they can control it, and then to put it to work, advancing the interests of their organization, their company, maybe their government. But it's not going to be shared widely, and I think that AGI will probably be running, I think it will arise multiple times in different places, and that there'll be competition between these AIs. And that the competition will probably be fairly advanced and fairly high stakes and serious before you or I or anybody we know is even aware of it. And so the question is, how will we become aware of it? And it might be when the lights go out or, you know, you get a check for $10 million or like something really life-changing happens to you and you try to figure out why it is. And the best explanation that you can come up with is there's a rogue AGI, which is very powerful and has lots of money, which is basically just pranking the world or has gone on its own recognizance out into the world to try to set things right. Or it's malicious. And instead of a check for $10 million, you get a bill for $10 million. And it's not some frivolous scam, you know, where somebody just sends out a bunch of bills that are fake and, you know, whoever pays them, hey, that's just gravy. You get a bill from, you get a letter from a prestigious law firm telling you that you're being sued by some huge entity for some, you know, astronomical amount of money. And it's for real. One thing that I can almost guarantee is that nobody's going to get exactly what they want when it comes to AI. unless what you want is basically, you know, the way the world is now, just faster and weirder. But people who are prophesying apocalypse, probably not going to go that way. People who are prophesying, you know, the eruption of perfection, the heaven on earth, that's not going to happen either. Things are going to be weird, but at the same time, like any black swan, you know, a black swan is an unanticipated event, but critical to the definition of a black swan is that while you couldn't have predicted it in advance, once it's happened and you look back on it, it seems obvious. And that, I think the, you know, the successful creation of an artificial general intelligence is going to be just that sort of, you can't even call it a black swan anymore since so many people are talking about it. It's kind of a gray rhino now, which is the obvious thing that is expected that you see coming from a long ways away, but you can't stop it. But along with the black swan and the gray rhino is, what do they call it? The something dragon, dragon king, dragon emperor, something like that, which is something which it's, I would liken it to Ian M. Banks' out of context problem. Something so outside of your experience suddenly impinges upon your experience to such a degree that, you know, you can't ignore it, but at the same time, given the life that you've lived up to that moment, you can't really make sense of it. And yet, going forward, it is a part of the context of your very existence that cannot be ignored and you have to come to terms with. That, I think, is what AGI will be, I don't know, in 10 years, 20 years, but the next 3 to 5 years. I mean, this last week was intensely interesting to me. I think the next few years are going to be intensely interesting. Anyway, if you've been following this OpenAI drama and you think there's a big piece of it that I haven't touched on, which, you know, certainly there is, do let me know. All right, I'm going to wrap it up here. I've got some stuff talking about AI in the military that I recorded a while ago that I never released. So I'm going to let that play now. But in terms of Thanksgiving and the day after, and I'm recording this actually in my mother's car at the cemetery where my mother's parents are buried. I think I'm going to get out and go stand in front of their grave for a bit before I move on. But from my perspective, we've come to the end. For you, there's another, I don't know, 20 minutes or so of material that I recorded a while ago. But thanks for listening, and I will talk to you again soon. Stay well. Hey, everybody. I want to share 3 pieces of news that came into my inbox over the last couple of days. Actually, most of them came into my inbox, I guess it was yesterday morning. And the first actually came into my physical mailbox. It is another issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. I paid for a year subscription. The year has elapsed, but they just keep sending them. And I've grown, I don't want to say contemptuous, but I have a negative attitude about the Foreign Affairs magazine in that it's written by political insiders for political insiders. So, you know, it's the elite sort of getting their story straight for each other before they disseminate it, you know, to the rest of the world, you know, or to the mainstream media, which then disseminates it to the rest of the world. It's boring. The house style, like the editorial imperative, is make it dull and make it not just dull, not just boring, but anodyne in the sense that it doesn't offend the sensibilities of the elites. So the article that I want to bring your attention to is AI is Already at War, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform the Military by Michelle A. Flournoy, who is co-founder and managing partner at West Exec Advisors and chair of the Center for a New American Security. She served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2012. So when I say, you know, these are stories or opinion pieces, they're not news. There's no fact gathering presented here. This is all, you know, high level opinion. So this is the establishment talking to itself. So as I say, it is a long article. It is boring. I've been looking for individual passages that I could read aloud to you, and none of them really stand out as something that's very exciting to listen to on their own. They all kind of require the ones before and after for context, and it's just, let me just give you an example. This is not a piece of the text that I think is particularly tight or meaningful. It's just to give you a sense of the style. So this is not from the beginning, just kind of in the middle. Fortnoy writes, "The Pentagon is aware of these risks, and in February of 2020, it issued a set of ethical principles governing how AI should be used. One principle called on the department's personnel to exercise judgment and care in developing, deploying, and using AI capabilities. Another said the Defense Department will try to, quote, minimize unintended bias in AI capabilities, close quote. A third called for ensuring that all AI is made and used in ways that can be understood and explained with data and methodologies that are transparent and auditable. And defense leaders have directed their employees to make sure that AI systems are rigorously tested for their safety, security, and effectiveness, that AI systems are assigned to clearly defined uses, and that AI systems can be disengaged or deactivated if they exhibit unintended behavior." Now, what's wrong with that, you might say? I mean, that all sounds like sensible advice. Anyway, it's just also very vague. I mean, it just doesn't say a whole lot. It's basically saying, make sure the AI does good stuff and not bad stuff. But this is a long piece, and that is not a fair description of, you know, the whole piece. I'm going to actually call upon Claude to help me summarize the whole thing. So the neat thing about Claude is that you can feed, you know, Claude is a large language model that is put out by Anthropic AI, and you can feed it up to 20,000 words as an input and ask it to analyze or summarize or whatever. So I went to the website and I got the digital version of this article, and I fed the whole thing to Claude, and Claude summarized it as follows. The article provides an insightful look into how AI is already transforming military capabilities and national security, while also discussing risks and governance challenges. Here are some of the key points. AI is enabling advances in areas like maintenance, resource allocation, intelligence analysis, and autonomous systems. It offers potential advantages in decision-making speed and battlefield situational awareness. However, adoption lags in the U.S. government due to workforce shortfalls and bureaucratic barriers. China is racing ahead in military AI investment. Key risks include accidents from uncontrolled AI weapons, data poisoning/hacking, and erosion of human oversight and ethics. Standards are needed to ensure safety and responsibility. The author argues the U.S. must accelerate AI adoption to maintain superiority while strengthening ethical guardrails. A balanced approach is needed to manage trade-offs between innovation and regulation. Recommendations include workforce expansion, acquisition reform, flexible funding, public-private partnerships, immigration changes, and multilateral norms/agreements on AI ethics and security. In summary, the article presents a nuanced perspective on optimizing militaries for an AI-driven future while mitigating risks. It highlights the complex interplay between technology, governance, and geopolitical competition in this domain. Claude was a lot kinder to the author than I was. And the author is clearly a very accomplished person. And again, I blame the in-house editorial style more than I blame the author. So in another piece of news, I got this through Breaking Points. That's the show with Sagar and Jetty and Crystal Ball. And Sagar and Crystal referenced a report that said the F-35 fighter, which is the most advanced, supposedly, fighter jet in the world, to say it's very expensive is absurd understatement. It is the most expensive defense procurement ever. And this fighter jet, of which, you know, the U.S. government in its various branches of the military has 400 of them, only 55% of them are capable of flying at any given moment. That is their mission capability percentage, 55%. So what they were referencing is something which, unlike the article I just mentioned, is quite short, very concise, and information dense. So I'm going to read that to you. So this is from the Financial Times, or FT.com, which is mostly a paywalled site, but every now and again they'll throw something out for the general populace, and this piece is free. F-35 fighter jets can only fly 55% of the time, U.S. watchdog says. Report on military's $160 million combat aircraft comes days after one crashed in South Carolina.
The Pentagon's costly fleet of F-35 fighter jets can only fly a little over half the time, as maintenance issues keep the aircraft on the ground, despite the growing reliance on the planes by the U.S. and its allies. The fleet's mission-capable rate, or the percentage of time a plane can perform one of its assigned missions, was 55% as of March of 2023, far below the Pentagon's goal of 85 to 90%, the government's accountability office said on Thursday. The report from the GAO, an independent congressional watchdog, was published just days after a Marine Corps F-35 crashed in South Carolina, prompting a search for the plane and raising questions over how it could have gone missing for days before its debris was located. The F-35's share of the U.S.'s overall tactical aviation fleet is expected to keep growing, providing a boon to its manufacturer, Lockheed Martin. Each of the fighter jets cost the government about $160 million. The U.S. military has 450 F-35s. Variants are used by the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, and the Pentagon plans to buy roughly 2,000 more by the mid-2040s, costing $1.7 trillion over the program's lifecycle, including $1.3 trillion for maintaining the aircraft. It is the world's costliest defense procurement project, replacing the main fighter for those three branches of the U.S. military, meaning they are, quote, flying an increasing amount of operational missions, close quote, according to the GAO report. U.S. allies in NATO and Asia, as well as Israel, have also added F-35s to their air forces. The U.K. Defense Ministry is one of the largest customers for the aircraft. Quote, maintenance challenges negatively affect F-35 aircraft readiness, close quote, with the poor level, quote, due in part to challenges with depot and organizational maintenance, close quote, the GAO said. The Pentagon is years behind in establishing enough maintenance depot capacity, resulting in repair delays and a 10% reduction in the jet's mission-capable rate. Part of the challenges stem from a heavy reliance on contractors for maintenance that limits the Pentagon's ability to control depot maintenance decisions. Delays also arise from spare parts shortages, inadequate maintenance training, insufficient support equipment, and lack of technical data needed to make repairs. The Pentagon will take over managing the F-35's sustainment by October 2027, making this a critical time for it to reassess the jet's underlying sustainment strategy, the GAO said. Quote, we stand ready to partner with the government as plans are created for the future of F-35 sustainment, ensuring missions readiness and enabling deterrence, close quote, Lockheed said in a statement. So basically, $1.7 trillion to have a little over 2,000 of these things in service for the next 30 years. So the piece from Foreign Affairs, AI is Already at War, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform the Military, by Michelle A. Flournoy, she mentions that some of the things that AI can do is in the realm of maintenance and logistics and inventory, basically keeping track of what is where. And a lot of what is keeping the F-35 grounded a lot more of the time than the Pentagon wants is the fact that, you know, all the systems for maintaining it are not really in place and operational just yet. It is the newest fighter with the most sophisticated needs, and there's long backlogs for maintenance. That's not the whole problem, but that's definitely part of it. So comparing the article in Financial Times about, you know, the F-35's unreadiness to fly, basically, and Ms. Flournoy's very detailed prescription about how AI can improve, you know, the efficiency and the readiness of the U.S. military generally, I fed the entirety of both articles into Claude, and I asked Claude to compare the two. And I said, could AI be used to make the F-35 a more reliable fighter jet? And Claude said, AI could potentially help improve the reliability and readiness of the F-35 fighter jet fleet in a few ways. Predictive maintenance. AI algorithms could analyze sensor data from the aircraft to predict maintenance needs before issues arise and schedule preventative repairs. This could reduce downtime and keep more jets mission ready. Supply chain optimization. AI could help model spare parts usage and demand to identify shortages earlier. It could also optimize logistics and transportation to get parts where they are needed faster. Technician training. AI-driven simulations and augmented/virtual reality
could help train maintenance crews faster and enable just-in-time refreshers on specific repair procedures. Here's one I thought was really provocative. Automated inspections. Computer vision algorithms could automate visual inspections of aircraft to identify any structural issues or wear and tear. This could free up maintenance hours. So imagine an untrained person just putting on a headset so that an AI can see what they're looking at, and that person just goes and looks at the plane. And the AI might tell them, oh, look over here, or hold your vision, you know, hold your view here for a second, or look under there. And the AI is just using the bodily movements of a basically, you know, untrained person, not necessarily a technician, just a person, to go and do a detailed visual inspection of a plane. Claude continues, diagnostic assistance. AI systems could help technicians quickly narrow down the root causes of repair issues by analyzing sensor data along with maintenance records. And process optimization. AI could find deficiencies in maintenance workflows and procedures to reduce downtime. It could also optimize staffing levels and shift patterns. However, integrating AI into complex military systems comes with challenges around trust, security, and adequate testing. Human oversight and domain expertise will still be critical. Overall, though, targeted AI applications could help address some of the readiness issues flagged in the article. And finally, I fed the transcript of a video, a YouTube video by a guy named David Shapiro. I watch a lot of his stuff. I don't talk about it a whole lot. It's a lot of it is more technical than I am capable of relaying to you just conversationally. And it's also very domain specific, more domain specific than I want to be, given what I know about my audience. I know that most of you are not as interested in artificial intelligence as I am. But rather than summarize, I'm just going to play you a bit of his video. This is David Shapiro summarizing a new executive order from the Biden administration on the topic of AI. Now, when you think of an executive order, how long do you think of it as being? I mean, I see it as like one sheet of paper, you know, with like four or five paragraphs of text on it, and this president signs at the bottom and says, I issue this order. This executive order on AI is 20,000 pages long. So here's David Shapiro giving a summary, a very high-level summary of those 20,000 pages.
The White House and President Joe Biden just issued a sweeping executive order yesterday morning, and it is quite a beast. So we're not going to go through all of the details, but I did want to show you the original, which is 20,000 words long. But I did take some Cliff's notes, so we'll go over that in just a second. So you can look at the entire executive order here. But then there's also the White House published kind of a high-level overview. But here's my notes. Here's the key takeaways. So first, what you need to know is that there are 19 federal agencies that have received directives because of this executive order, including the Department of Commerce, NIST, which we already knew, the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and the Department of Treasury were the ones that really stood out to me. So one, this is very comprehensive. You rarely see executive orders that are this sweeping that basically involve, I'm not going to say most because I don't know how many federal agencies there are. I think there's over 60. You know, like the Department of Agriculture, for instance, was not included in this. But some of the big ones, namely the Department of Defense, aka the Pentagon, the entire U.S. military, Homeland Security, Energy, all kinds of agencies were involved in this. So what were they told to do? So the general themes that I saw were, first and foremost, safe, secure, and responsible development of AI across all sectors, including risk management, education, transportation, governance, oversight, et cetera, et cetera. That is pretty boilerplate. That's nothing to write home about. Protecting civil rights, privacy, consumer, and workers. This is where it starts to get interesting. Obviously, protecting civil rights, this is America, we love freedom, yes, go on. Go forth and be prosperous. Privacy, consumers, this again is nothing to write home about. The EU is actually ahead of America, as far as I can tell, with respect to technology and privacy and consumer protection. But worker protection is one of the things that is kind of like, So I was talking to a lot of people about this, and basically, you know me, I am 100% in the camp of post-labor economics. Let's get people out of the workforce so that we can do other stuff. Let's get off of the rat race. Let's get off of the workaholic treadmill. But Most people are not there yet. So my reading of this is that the president doesn't want to hurt his chances of reelection, so he's not going to lean into post-labor economics. Instead, he's going to make some perfunctory stuff saying, like, let's protect workers. And in America, for my audience that's not in America, one thing that happens every presidential election cycle is they go into coal country and steel country and the Rust Belt, and they're like, we're going to bring jobs back. And it's never happens. Why? Because coal jobs are going away. Why? Because car jobs are going away and steel jobs are going away. But they always make the noises to say, we're going to bring jobs back. Now, I will say that in some cases, we are onshoring jobs, but usually those are jobs that don't go to blue-collar laborers like coal workers. It's going to high-tech workers like chip fabs and solar and that sort of thing. So anyways, still, the fact that the tone is being set at the highest level saying, we're going to protect all of these things is really interesting. Now, where it gets even more interesting, this is where it starts to be something really worth writing home about. Increasing AI innovation and competitiveness, so investments, public-private partnerships, standards, updating intellectual property policy. This is all stuff that I touched on with my Gatto framework, and the Gatto community helped me brainstorm a few months ago. So we're basically seeing, like, getting our entire wish list, our entire Christmas list answered with this one executive order. Because the thing is, let's just pick this apart. Investments. Obviously, the investment in AI is there, but having AI being invested in at the federal level is a good thing. So, there's already been some evidence that, like, the IRS and other federal agencies are starting to use AI. I just did a video yesterday about NASA, which is still a federal agency that is using ChatGPT, which is great. So what we want to see is this adoption curve accelerate. Now, obviously, you don't want to go at a breakneck pace. You don't want to overly rely on novel technologies that could make mistakes and harm people and so on and so forth. But at the highest level, the highest office in the land is saying, yes, this is permission to invest in these technologies, which is good. So that's the first thing that's really worth writing home about. Next is increasing AI expertise and capacity in the federal workforce. So this is very explicitly saying we want AI experts to be working for the U.S. government. Not just saying that we're going to, increase AI competency out in the workforce. It's saying we want to bring it in-house, which to me, this is one of the best pieces of information because, one of the key things that often happens with new technologies is that the federal government just says, okay, well, we'll create an expert advisory board and then mostly ignore them. But in this case, it's saying, no, we want in-house expertise, which is a pretty significant investment. Now, the other thing is coordinating AI efforts across federal agencies via new councils. And I'll enumerate some of these new councils and working groups in a second. But when 19 plus federal agencies are ordered, you're working together on this. That is a level of coordination that we have not seen outside of crisis, right? This is the level of coordination that we haven't seen since like World War II and the Red Scare and that sort of thing. So this is what proactive government looks like. And I know that many of you in my audience are anti-government, and I hear you. And I do agree that power always needs to be scrutinized, which is why I'm making this video, so that you are more aware of what the government is doing. And then finally, advancing international collaboration. So this was layer six of the Gatto framework, which is international cooperation. So it's still focused on AI standards and risk management. They're still not doing international research. This is the one thing on my wish list that I have not seen anyone talking about, and that is I want to see international, if not global, cooperation on AI research, not just guardrails, not just regulation, not just watchdogs. I want to see research, positive research that is open source and global. Now, obviously, I understand that there are reasons not to do that because AI can be weaponized, so you don't necessarily want to just, open Pandora's box there. But still, I think that it would behoove us to explicitly say this is a transformative technology that is on the scale of nuclear fusion and everything else that, like, we need to invest in this on an international level. Now, last bit is I want to talk about some of those new entities that are created. So notably missing from this, and this is what some people asked for, was to create a cabinet-level agency or a new agency. This executive order does not create a new agency, but instead it basically orders all agencies to create new groups and new positions within those agencies in order to basically tackle AI. So first and foremost, the White House Artificial Intelligence Council. So this reports directly to the president and the deputy chief of staff. So this is basically a high-level expert group that works directly with the highest office in the land. So this is good. I don't know who it's going to be in there. Obviously, if it gets contaminated with, you know, corporate interests and lobbyists, that could be bad. But I get the sense that they're not going to do that. So the other one is the chief artificial intelligence officers to be designated within each federal agency. So basically, they're creating a new C-level position for each agency listed, which is basically creating someone who is at the top of the food chain who is responsible for artificial intelligence. So this is alongside what you might think of as a chief technology officer or a chief information security officer. So now there's going to be a CAIO, chief AI officer, which honestly, I would, for all of you business people out there, all of you entrepreneurs and CEOs, I would recommend that all companies do this too.
Okay, so that's David Shapiro. It's not the whole video. And in fact, I edited out, you know, bits of what I played to you just to increase the flow. But I asked Claude after feeding, you know, it. I think of Claude as a he, but it's an it. The entire text of the transcript of the video of which you just heard an excerpt. And I asked it, what parallels can you draw between the transcript of the video by David Shapiro and the article on AI in the military from Foreign Affairs? And Claude said the following. There are a few interesting parallels between the perspectives on AI and the military expressed in the David Shapiro video and the Foreign Affairs article. Both emphasize the need for the U.S. military to accelerate adoption of AI capabilities to maintain strategic advantages, though the risks of uncontrolled systems are acknowledged. They highlight deficiencies in expertise and bureaucratic barriers to effectively leveraging AI and suggest reforms like new workforce programs and acquisition processes. Ensuring AI safety and ethics is a theme in both, with the Foreign Affairs author advocating strengthening the Pentagon's principles and oversight further. The competitive dynamic with China comes up in both as fueling the drive for military AI advancement in the U.S. They share a focus on applications like intelligence analysis, autonomous systems, logistics optimization, and command and control, where AI could confer military advantages. However, the Foreign Affairs piece goes into more depth on battlefield applications of AI and weighs more cautious risks like accidents and data poisoning, whereas the video has a broader scope. Neither promotes collaborative international governance of military AI, instead viewing it through a national competitiveness lens. So in summary, while coming from different perspectives, they align on the strategic importance of military AI development while reinforcing similar themes around risks, governance, and great power competition shaping this domain. And then I ask it to expand on the battlefield applications of AI mentioned in the article in Foreign Affairs. And Claude gave the examples of autonomous drones flying ahead to map buildings and identify targets during raids, as illustrated in the opening vignette. This reduces risks to human troops. Computer vision algorithms rapidly scanning battlefield imagery to detect and classify objects of interest like tanks or missiles. This helps intelligence analysts. AI-enabled control of multiple unmanned aerial, ground, or underwater systems at once, for example, using drone swarms to overwhelm adversary defenses. And let me just pause there and say that drone swarms is something that the Chinese military is putting heavy emphasis on in their research and development programs. Claude continues, resilient networks that use AI to dynamically reroute connections if communications are disrupted, maintaining battlefield awareness. AI assistance to help commanders or soldiers access options and make decisions faster than the enemy during engagements. AI-guided munitions that can independently select targets based on algorithms. This raises ethical issues. And predictive maintenance via AI to optimize readiness of weapon systems and logistics. This reduces downtime. So that relates to the F-35. But I want to focus on the two before that, of helping both soldiers and commanders assess options and make decisions faster than the enemy can on the battlefield, thus conferring a strategic advantage or a tactical advantage on the battlefield. And also
AI-guided munitions that could independently select targets based on algorithms. And Claude doesn't mention it there, but if you read up more on that topic, a lot of what they're talking about is launching, say, a cruise missile toward a theater of battle without having a specific target in mind and having the AI itself continuously gathering intelligence data while it's in flight, and also, you know, using computer vision to analyze where it's going and to look for the best targets of opportunity. So both of these two applications, military applications of AI, helping making better decisions and also making, you know, real-time adjustments and intelligent target acquisition, both of these are taking decision-making out of human hands and automating it. Now, Claude says this brings up ethical issues. I think this just brings up issues of self-preservation. I mean, I don't want to go all, you know, Terminator, Judgment Day, Doomsday sort of, you know, scaremongering. I think that's all fairly silly and not at all the sorts of things we really need to focus on. But at the same time, you know, the places where it makes sense to maintain human decision-making is in realms where, you know, human lives are in the balance, where people are, they're weighing the value, the strategic value of some piece of ground or of taking out some enemy and balancing that against the fact that the actions being taken will end human lives. I think that's one place where we really want to keep humanity in the loop, but it could be that aspects of competition, you know, geopolitical competition, military competition, they incentivize taking human judgment out of the loop because it's too slow. All right, so saying nothing about Israel, the Palestinians, Gaza, or the West Bank, or Lebanon, or Egypt, just in general, the U.S. military and its allies, Great Britain, Japan, Australia, South Korea, all of Western Europe, they seem to have gone AI toy crazy. I mean, not just in artificial intelligence, but in big budget, high-tech weapon systems over more sort of old-fashioned concerns about deploying and supplying troops, making sure they have weapons and ammunition and food and clothing. There's this idea that technology can leapfrog previously dominant considerations when it comes to warfare and also, you know, what is war but politics by other means, basically geopolitical competition. I'm not anti-tech. I am no longer a collapsnik. But I certainly do think that it is quite possible to get out over one's skis, you know, in terms of relying on not just AI, but technology in general for your defense or, you know, for your politics by other means. And that what ultimately is probably going to prove most necessary, most useful, most the final word in any combat is going to be who is standing on the ground and controlling it. You can control it from space, or you can control it from, you know, aircraft carriers at sea hundreds of miles away, you know, but in that sense, control just means you can kill who's ever standing on it. But that's a very temporary state of affairs, and you can't really do much with that. All you can do is prevent somebody else from making use of that particular piece of land. But to actually control it, to actually decide what happens there, you need to have your people on the ground in overwhelming force, which means they need food, they need a place to sleep, they need dry socks, and they need ammunition for their rifles, and you need munitions for, you know, your planes, your artillery. Old-fashioned stuff is ultimately, I think, what's going to rule the day, so long as, you know, until the day when wars are primarily fought via robot soldiers. That, I think, is a ways off, if it ever comes. I could be wrong about that. Things could well move faster than I expect. Okay, that's not the whole podcast, but I'm going to make this a sort of self-contained segment.